So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Thank you, we have approved minutes from November 19th. Good morning again, we've had our safety message already from Acting Safety Director Lou Brown, so I'd like to briefly go over today's agenda and we'll get started. Our first item concerns our confidential closed reporting system and its expansion to cover Metrobus, now covers Metro Rail. I would like to note that along with Assistant General Manager of Bus Services, Bob Potts, we also have our labor union partners here with us today, Ms. Jackie Jeter from ATU Local 689. Is she here? Yes, she is here. Ms. Farlene Bui, is it Bui? Thank you. Who is the president of Teamsters Local 922, and Ralph Schmidt, the deputy director of the Department of Transportation's Bureau of Transportation Statistics, and we will, everyone will learn shortly while he is here as well. Welcome. Afterwards, as the second order of business, Acting Chief Safety Officer Lou Brown will update the committee on the status. There it is. On the status of the NTSB investigation into January's incident at L'Enfant Plaza, Metro's progress in responding to the FDA's Safety Management Inspection Corrective Action, and the work and this week's FTA Safety Directive dealing with corrective action plans submitted to the TOC in the past. This is an ongoing work to improve Metro's safety culture. And finally, Chief Pavlik will provide some security project updates regarding the Security Operations Control Center, emergency training and emergency drills, and the fire department liaison position, which is located in the Rail Operation Control Center. So I'll now turn the floor over to Mr. Potts and our guest to discuss our first item, the expansion of the close call reporting to Metrobus. Mr. Potts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning to everyone. Today I'm joined by my labor partners, 922 and 689, Alderman Schmidt, to announce the expansion of our close call program. What is the close call program? It's an avenue for employees to confidentially and without fear to report safety concerns to the third party. These concerns are then depersonalized and provided back to a management labor peer team to establish root causes leading to the incident and preventive actions that should be taken to stop it from happening again. It is important to note that a close call incident is not one where there are any injuries or damage to vehicles or equipment. Rather, it is a near miss. 2.5 years ago, in 2013, Metro became the first rail transit agency to launch a confidential close call transit safety reporting system. Due to an effective partnership between the ETU 689 and management, as well as the U.S. Department of Transportation Bureau of Transportation Statistics, we established a program that has enhanced safety by increasing opportunities for forward reporting of events that have potential for more serious consequences. This program is governed by a memorandum of understanding between the parties involved. We are here today to announce that program, initially designed exclusively for rail and transit infrastructure employees, is now being expanded to include bus employees. This will mark yet another first for Metro that we become the first bus transit agency with this program. With the addition of Bus, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Local 922 is joining us as part. So what are the types of safety concerns brought forward by rail and transit infrastructure over the past few years? Here are two examples from employees who work out on the tracks or is maintaining equipment. And I'm quoting from the quarterly close call employee newsletter that keeps staff informed of the program. I think copies of those documents are in front of them. For example, one reporting need to improve safe work practices in overlapping work zones. It's not uncommon for multiple work groups to perform tasks in the same work zone. The roadway worker in charge, RWIC, is solely responsible for setting the rules for all parties in the work zone, whether employees or contractors. Conflicts arise when all parties working in the zone are not clear on the role and responsibilities of the RWRC. What we've done, the Capital Program Delivery Office worked with SAFE and Local 689 to determine the best resolution to approach overlapping work side of the road and work protection responsibilities while working on the roadway. resolution is now being issued as a directive to all employees. Another example of the report involved the safety in and around shops. A standard operating procedure was created by car maintenance to keep personnel working in and around shops safe at all times. Last week, the outline of the SOP was followed to prevent employee injuries and fatalities. What we've done, we perform random, unannounced audits on various shifts by cross-departmental supervisory personnel, quality assurance, and safety departments at all shop locations regarding the SOP compliance. And as we expand this program to budget, we'll provide examples to our employees during the training period for them to report various incidents through the system, such as unsafe bus turnaround areas, near-miss accidents due to blind spots or equipment issues, speeding events, operating on the wrong side of the road, not stopping at railroad crossings, not using personal protective equipment, or improper use of tools to get the job done. The post-call program builds on the other initiatives Metro has put in place to encourage employees to report safety concerns. The bottom line is that we want to know what we don't know. And post-call reporting is a proven way of gathering information at a stage when we can act to prevent more serious safety incidents, reverse bad habits, or address emerging trends. Simply, this program helps us to move from reactive to proactive. And as you may recall, the post-call program addresses National Safety Transportation Board recommendation in June 2009 Metro Rail accident to develop and implement a non-punitive safety program for the agency. Now I'd like to ask Ms. Jeter to say a few words about the program and how it works.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
This effort will continue the creation of a safer culture, and it is the reason for the partnership. Confidentiality for employees who report close calls. Confidentiality for employees who report close calls is critical for the success of the pilot. It allows them to report events that would otherwise go unreported. Revealing a lot of new information about what's going on out there in the work environment every day from the safety point of view. We recognize that employees are often unwilling to self-report events that could result in adverse outcomes because in doing so, they may be disciplined themselves or see their coworkers disciplined. It's important to state that that an incident is not a close call if it involves accident, injury, illness, or medical treatment. It is something that almost happened or could have happened. We have seen close call reporting beginning to take off in our rail and transit infrastructure groups. Many different types of employees in different work groups, whether operations or maintenance, are participating. The outcome that has been a number of there has been a number of preventive actions taken by management that result directly from those confidential reports. Bob highlighted on some of them. And I want to take a moment because we didn't just do this by ourselves. There's a group of people that have been working with us on a continuous basis to get to this point. I see Phil Wallace from Bus Maintenance sitting there, Dolores Proctor, Gail Gray from Labor Relations, Demetra from BTS, Andrea Burnside, who has always been there helping us on a regular basis, and our safety officer, Mr. Medeiros. We have all worked together to get to this point, and it wasn't an easy one, but we are here. Briefly, here's how the program works. One, an eligible employee experiences a close call, for example, due to speeding, improper flagging, unsafe bus turnaround, an equipment or environmental issue. Not all unsafe events are eligible, such as red signal violations or failing to secure a bus. Within 16 hours of the close call incident, the employee confidentially reports the incident to BTS using an online reporting system or by telephone to initiate a report. They must complete the report within 24 hours. BTS receives the report, confirms eligibility, and provides the employee with a receipt. A BTS safety analyst follows up with confidential telephone interview. BTS provides information to a joint Metro Local 689, now 922 group, about the event. Without employee names being identified, the group establishes root cause and recommends preventive actions to stop similar events from happening in the future. Management reviews, accepts, and directs implementation of these actions. Metro Local 689, 922, and BTS will provide constant feedback to the employee's population about the outcome of the close call reports. This step is important because employees need to know that we hear them and that we are doing something about the events that they report. Quarterly newsletter reports detail that employees what the employees' concerns are and how they are being addressed. We share them with our members, management distributes them, and they are posted on the BTS close call website. Employees' close call reports is a statistic that we want to go up, and we expect, as bus employees are included, that it will. Also, I'd like to mention Mr. Troop, and he's been there with us all through the process. So I thank you, and any questions that you all have to ask, we will answer them.
Potts, thank you. Just one or two questions. Perhaps for Ms. Jeter, or unless Mr. Potts knows, can you give us some examples from the close call reporting on the rail side of safety concerns that have come to light and how they were resolved and corrected?
Sure. One of the major events that we've been looking at is there was a flagging, the flagging incident on entering and exiting the shop. The audiovisual warning systems were installed, designated shop flagmen for each shift, and they clarified the prospective duties beginning the shifts. That's one of the directives that has come out of the incident that occurred. We've improved ROCC and the roadway worker communications during the switch movements, which was optional. It's a change to the SOPs. The RICs must only perform RIC duties now instead of just doing everything all over the railroad and not be utilized for other job tasks. Signs have been posted at shop doors indicating that train operators must stop and follow the procedures, and the company vehicle logbook information standardized to include vehicle maintenance and defect information. So those are some of the changes that have come about because of that.
Thank you. Just a question for Mr. Schmidt, who may as well make you, since you've come here. The information provided by the call-in by a person is kept confidential, I assume. And what do you do with that information? Do you eventually destroy it after a number of years, or how are your files kept on information that's supposed to be kept confidential?
I'll have Demetra, the project manager, describe.
That's from the freedom.
My voice is very soft. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Is that better? Okay. So the data are collected under strict confidentiality. The Bureau, thank you, helps with my back. BTS collects the data under a strict pledge of confidentiality, which is a very formal procedure dictated in the law that we invoke for this data collection, that law being the Confidential Information Protection and Statistical Efficiency Act, short for CIPSE. That law provides the most, the strongest data protection provisions we have available to all the federal statistical agencies. Data collected under CIPSE can never be FOIA'd, can never be subpoenaed, can never be shared with other statistical agencies, state or federal agencies, or WMATA in this case. So all the microdata are kept within the BTS data secure room, which has a separate computer network that's now part of the DOT network. Also, CIPSE, the law, directly protects the identity of the individual, and the statistical agencies are under obligation to protect that the reporter's identity from direct and indirect identification. Therefore, we are required to protect that data from disclosure even through indirect means, meaning if you say enough about the story that someone can put two and two together and identify the reporter, BTS will be in violation of CPSI. So OMB has issued a separate implementation guidance that directs all the statistical agencies what they have to do to protect data collected under CPSI, and we do all of that for the WMATA data. Names of the employees, once the case is worked through, are no longer kept in the system. The details of the case are kept in the system primarily because it's considered good research data and will be kept with BTS for as long as the data are viewed as relevant data and useful for research. Once we get to a point where the data are too old because of changes in the system, then that data will be deleted. We're not there yet. Usually, we've done the rail study for 8 years now, and that data is still very useful. So based on past experience, if I had to suggest probably a decade, for a decade, that data would still be relevant for safety research. But one thing you also need to know, because these data are collected under CPSI, we are not required to turn the data over to the National Archives Agency, because CPSI data cannot be shared with other agencies. So once the data are no longer useful, they will be deleted entirely.
Okay. Just to be clear about this, so the information is not available for disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act, and second, once a case is resolved, the actual name of the confidential party making the complaint or making the report is deleted. All right. Thank you. Mr. Boulder.
You sort of answered the question, but let me rephrase the data question. In all the presentation, there's nothing in here that says that an eligible close call resulted. We don't know how many close calls there have been, right? We have no idea. There could be one. There could be thousands, right?
Correct.
We don't know, but we don't know how many eligible ones.
So I can tell you that so far we have. We've had 57 reports in the system
that were eligible.
Okay. That we have worked, and I can tell you that out of those, we have the peer review team, this joint team that decides on preventative safety actions. They have come up with 45 preventative safety actions.
In the future, the high-level numbers give us some context.
Sure.
When we go over to the bus side, right? Just so the board knows it's working.
Absolutely.
We can
provide you a standardized format.
Thank you. Mr. Goni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Ms. Jeter's clarification that if a close call is not something where the incident actually occurred and there was an injury, et cetera, but what I don't get a sense of is whether we distinguish between something that's an imminent safety hazard or something that can be part of a statistical roll-up and that we'll hear about what happened to it a quarter later or longer. Is there any way that you do any sorting of that information so that something that seems like it might be an immediate issue, even though there hasn't been an incident, could be handled more expeditiously?
No, actually, during the training and the rollout of the program, we very clearly explained to the employees that incidents that are of imminent danger do not qualify as close calls, and the organization has other means to address those.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Chair Downing.
Is there a process to be sure that every relevant request is followed up on?
Yes.
Yeah. So, and does the individual who made the notice get particular attention that it has been dealt with?
Sure. And I can tell you what we do if you want. We have subject matter experts who do the confidential phone interviews, and during the interview, we ask the employee if they would like a follow-up.
If they'd like to follow-up.
And that's how we do follow-up.
Thank you.
Yes.
Ms. Boy, I assume Local 922 fully supports the expansion of the close call to Bluff?
Absolutely, yes.
Thank you. And do you want to just take a moment and describe why you're here? What we'll give you a chance to give a promotion for your employees, your members.
I'm here because I think this is a good thing for the bus operators. They go through so much out there every day driving the buses, so they need a second mechanism to make sure that the safety that they have to be responsible for is taken care of on a daily basis. And this is another tool that will help them, prevent them from doing things that's not right.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, we're going to roll this out at the beginning of the year. We're anxious to move it forward. There'll be extensive training on all the bus divisions, 922 as well as 689. So we're developing a rollout program right now with information materials. We'll ask both presidents to get the shop stewards involved and the designated safety officers to make sure that the information is out there so that our bus operators can take advantage of the system.
Very good. Now, this is an excellent initiative. I'm glad we were able finally to expand it to bus as well as Metrorail. It seems to be very successful, as both Ms. Jeter and yourself have indicated. So we look forward to it to working very well on the bus side as well. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll now shift a little bit and have Mr. Brown come forward and give us a little update on various safety matters underway.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman Goldman. I'm pleased to provide an update since our last meeting on some recent progress. Most notably this week, I think many of you are aware that the FTA issued Safety Directive 16-2. In that safety directive, they conveyed to us 217 tri-state oversight findings that we had actually had interaction with the tri-state oversight before. What the FTA has done is, in an effort to improve the efficiency, they've consolidated those 217 actually into 153 findings and subdivided those into four categories, and I'll go into more detail on the next page. And I apologize, it is a little confusing. We've had about 36 hours to digest the actual action. The directive does not include all the existing 91 SMI caps. However, a portion of those 153 are migrated over and assumed into the 22 of the 91. So it gets confusing when you try to do the consolidation, but I hopefully will be able to walk you through it. The findings will now be resolved under FTA oversight, and approved correction action plans are already underway. So of these 153 findings, as I mentioned, there's four categories. The first category were essentially directed to complete the action. So that consists of 102 previous tri-state oversight findings. We're to carry those forward and complete the action. Let me just step back for a second and make sure that I clarify. And I go into more detail later on, but it's important to understand the corrective action process in that these corrective actions are developed from findings that come from a variety of sources. Many of which are WMATA's own internal accident investigations, our own internal audits. So the majority of these are not new to us. They're ones that we've already been in great detail engaged with the Tri-State Oversight Committee in the past. When we receive the finding, it's WMATA's responsibility to generate the corrective action between safety and working with the various departments that are affected. And so maybe an overall statement of all of this is there's really nothing new here. There were no new surprises. Many of these actions were already underway or were well aware of these. The second category, the FTA is going to require some additional action on eight of those that came over from the TOC. This is the part that actually starts to get confusing when you get into Category 3. They've taken a multitude, well, actually 21 of the actions that of the 153 that were consolidation. So the 217 and collapsing it down to 153, there may be four, five, six, you know, half a dozen previous TOC findings that are now identified just in one FTA finding that we're working with them to understand if we previously had approved corrective actions from the TOC, whether if you take those six, say, previously approved corrective actions and they're consolidated into one new FTA one, we're working with them to understand, do we have to create one new corrective action or do the previous six work? And the last category that I mentioned were they're taking, of those 217, there were 64 caps that they are assuming into the 91 SMI. So, and they're assuming them into 22 of the SMI. So they'll be handled under that process that's already in existence and underway. And I apologize. It's confusing for us. Hopefully I'm articulating it as in an understandable way as possible. In a summary sort of form, 43% of the 217 that came over were WMATA-generated corrective actions from either internal safety reviews or our own accident investigations. So I know there is a perception that these may be new and WMATA's, I'll use my own words, caught by surprise, and that, I just want to assure you that is not the case. You know, we're well versed on these, and many of the actions are already underway. Okay. And they actually also, one other last comment on that, they do include, Mr. Troop is sitting to my left, the NTSB early action items. I believe there were 14 that we had, and I'll talk about those later, that the TOC had adopted and assigned findings to, and we created corrective actions that were already created with the early actions. And so, for instance, of the 217, 14 of those were already in progress with the NTSB. Okay. Now, if I haven't confused you completely, I just want to stress this, as I was mentioning, the corrective action process. So no matter what the source, whether it be triennial audit, accident investigation, internal safety, or security audits, we follow the same process to develop and approve the caps that are listed in this document. As a reminder, as part of a healthy safety program, there should always be findings. There should always be findings from internal safety and security audits as well as from investigations. That's a sign of a healthy organization when we're identifying our own problems and taking action upon them. Just the process here is that with TOC's oversight, they had adopted those and now have been passed to the FTA. So I just want to make sure to dispel any misconception about these corrective actions. Many of these are WMATA initiated. Not from external sources telling us something we didn't already know. Okay, just a real quick overview, and I apologize for the duplicity. We did cover this in a previous safety committee meeting, but this is the summary of the 91 corrective actions that we received from the FTA. It contains 54 findings. With 78 of the 91 actions, 78 are Metro Rail and 13 are Metro Bus. As I mentioned, there is an overlap, so you can't say you take those 91 and add them to the 217. It's a little bit convoluted. Probably the best would be, I had said, you consolidate down to 153, you subtract the 22 that they are moving over to the SMI. Hopefully you're following me, gives you 131. So at the most, you would say 131 plus the 91 is what we're looking at. That does also include close to two dozen that we've already submitted closure information to. That process got put on hold in October when we went through this transition phase. So we have not received any closed corrective actions since we've started the FTA transition process, but they will be forthcoming. Keeping it moving, just to give you a sense of the magnitude of this process for the SMI, you're aware of the 91 corrective actions. That includes, if you break that down, there are 538 deliverables that are due, and some of those deliverables have monthly reports that are due every month. Gives you a grand total of 700, or actually in excess of 700 actionable items that we're working on. No small task. We have submitted the master schedule and PMP to the FTA on time, and actually I'm pleased to report from our meetings this week with the FTA that we're receiving very positive feedback from them concerning the project management plan, so that's good news. We are doing regular weekly submittals to the FTA to address the 91 corrective actions. I believe the process is working very well, and that's confirmed by our FTA counterparts. And I should mention the TOC is a piece of this, too. They're an integral piece. They're being included in this process. Okay, just a quick update to the best I can on the derailment investigation report. We're continuing dialogue with FTA. As you well know, we were working with the TOC, and that got moved over to the FTA with their assumption of the oversight role. We now understand from the FTA that they're consolidating the comments both from their own within the FTA, from the Tri-State Oversight Committee, and then they each have their own respective sets of contractors, and they're in the process of consolidating that all to transmit to us. And it's my understanding that the transmission, based upon my conversation with the FTA, will include some clarification questions, some comments for our consideration, and they've suggested that they will be prepared to have this discussion at our now regularly scheduled monthly accident incident meeting in mid-January. So I apologize that I can't give you anything more definitive as to, I know the board is anxious for a report out from that investigation. As a reminder, we can't do that until we receive the approval from the oversight entity, and that's in progress. It's a work in progress, but I can't make any promises on timetable at this time. Next, on the FTA oversight, I would just say, overall, we have had constant communication with them on a regular basis, at least a phone call or more a day. We did have two full days of meeting, Monday and Wednesday this week. I think we're making a lot of progress. We're meeting all of our deliverables on time. And there's good dialogue, the quality of our deliverables, we're getting good feedback from the FTA. We're hoping that we reach a closure pretty soon on at least our first one. They have a lot of the documentation already to be able to do that, but they're still working through that. One reminder was we did talk about, I think, at the last month's meeting of dialogue with the FTA to set up a safety management system training, abbreviated training, executive training for the board, and I'm in dialogue with the FTA. We're trying to come up with some reasonable dates. It would be like a two-hour training. We just have to find out when everybody's schedule would work out and when the FTA trainers would be able to do that, but that is still ongoing. I think that would help tremendously in your understanding of our dealings with the FTA. Just real briefly on the NTSB recommendation, NTSB investigation, that is also ongoing. Excellent regular communication. I probably receive at least a phone call a week from the investigator in charge. They're in the process of writing their final report with clarification questions or, you know, could you get this piece for us, that piece, and we've been extremely responsive. In fact, as recently as last Friday, we have given a tremendous amount of information to the FTA, to the NTSB, such that I almost think it's unprecedented, and they were a bit overwhelmed with the amount of reports and notes pages and documentation that we provided. And sometimes they come back to us since they have received so much, we know what we gave them almost a little better than what they had a chance to digest, so I get regular calls from them saying, we know you already submitted this to us, but could you either point us to it or could you do us a favor and send us it again, and we're happy to do that. It is looking like the NTSB final report, due to their own internal scheduling, is going to be in spring of 2016. That will include a convening of the NTSB board and a public meeting at that time. We had anticipated it was going to be earlier next year, but that's the current indication is spring of 2016 due to scheduling constraints. Just lastly, and I'm going to actually read it verbatim, that WMATA continues to be focused on implementing all corrective action plans in an open and transparent environment to improve upon the safety of our customers, employees in Washington metropolitan region. And we are very serious about this. We're very dedicated to this, and we have been extremely transparent. Just another quick piece before I end, we are anticipating also the FTA protocol for our accident incident notification process. We were thinking we were going to have that by this week, but I think it may be, should be before the end of the year, and then we'll have a better sense going forward of reporting requirements and those kinds of things. Any questions, sir?
I'm sure there are. Let me ask you two quick questions. First, let me thank you for that report and also for bringing into your report the information on the FTA action of this week on the TOC corrective action plans. On the FTA corrective actions, the first question is, on the FAA's website, they show that six of those corrective action plans are due to be completed this month. I just want to make sure that the agency is on time and those six that are marked to be completed in December 2015 will be completed in December 2015.
And it's a terminology piece, so when we say completed, WMATA has completed our action piece and submitted the documentation or will have submitted it by the end of this month. Everything is on time and on schedule. I can't say that we will have closure from the FTA, that they have to digest everything that we've given them. And so when we say completed, WMATA will have completed its portion, and we're totally up to date.
Thank you. In the material that you provided to the committee, it shows that in the FY17 budget, in order to carry out these 91,
correct,
or at least some of these 91 caps, there's an added $11 million in the operating budget and then identified a little over $9 million in the capital budget. Can you just highlight what that money is for? What are the specific corrective action plans that that money is responsive to?
If Mr. Anasecki is here, because I am principally focused more on the deliverables and not as much on the money side. I can attempt. I know there are things on the bus side. We lost Mr. Potts also. On the bus side, additional training components. There is an IT component that goes across the board, both on the bus and the rail side, so some of those are some large expenditures. Rob, maybe on the rail side, Rob.
So on the operational side, most of the operations budget deals with increase in workforce. Specifically, one of the largest increases in our quality control, quality assurance group. Again, we created the quality assurance internal compliance organization, which will be spread across all disciplines, including bus, not just rail, but to be able to go and make internal compliance checks on preventive maintenance procedures, safety audits, everything else that goes along there. So that's one of the largest increases in the personnel. I think that's 20 people. Some of the larger increases in the capital side deal with being able to get training programs developed, being able to get consultants in to be able to consultant work for engineering practices. And additionally, one of the largest ones is to be able to provide programmable local controllers for our fan controls. Right now we have a lot of analog and relay mechanisms. We have been through a process just through our regular operating budget of advancing those to programmable local controllers. As part of the recommendations, they said they wanted to advance that quicker, so we're pulling in capital budget to be able to do that.
Those are the ventilation, the big ventilation fans?
The ventilation fans, that's correct, yes.
Okay,
yes.
And that's part of, that's capitalized expense.
That's correct, yes.
Thank
yes.
you. Mr. Biancola.
Yeah, thank you for the report. We are receiving, as I recall, monthly cap reports anyways, aren't we? I don't recall getting one in November.
Unfortunately, we were told by the FTA when they took over to stop that process until we went through this consolidation.
Okay,
and
all right.
So I'm looking for those to begin.
That leads into my next question.
Okay.
I'm presuming they're not complaining about the format of it. Are they going to be changing the format of it as far as you know? And also, is it including a factor of what's high, medium, low risk? In other words, there's some weighting of the safety deficiencies that are being identified, as well as a timeline.
Right.
I assume the cap itself has a timeline on it.
Absolutely.
And then there's a whole issue then of your monitoring of it. Clearly, most of the work's going to be done by the operations and either the operations side or through capital program items. But to some degree, there should be some monitoring of it, and or the quality assurance or control quality control with the operators, quality assurance by your office. So can you talk about that a little bit? And
certainly. So format-wise, it will be changing some because I think what will be important to do, at least for the interim period until we get through all the existing TOC caps that migrated over, is to have that traceability of how they've moved from the old TOC number to the new FTA number. So we'll be modifying our report to include that so that one could track the...
So a new numbering system, too, huh?
Yes, interestingly enough, a new numbering system. It's, yes.
Maybe rather numbers.
The other piece of your questions?
Well, it's just, you know, as long as we can be assured as a board that we
right.
can kind of look at this as well.
Okay.
Hopefully, FTA will allow us to look at it.
Right. So
I know it will be published on their website. But you know.
It will be published on their website, but we're going to be adding more detail along the lines of our previous TOC monthly report that we had. I know what your other piece of the question was, the like hazard rating and those kinds of things for the prioritization. As you may recall, the previous report already had the hazard rating for the existing TOC caps. We will continue that process with the FTA caps, so that will be included. And I think my intent, once we get this ironed out with the FTA and the consolidation, is to begin that monthly report. It probably won't make sense to have it in time for the end of the month. It would probably be better to have it to you all a week or 2 weeks before this committee meeting, so you would have a chance to digest that and we could discuss that. It's really going to become more of us being the customer of that report, as opposed to the FTA will have their own on their website, but it won't have enough detail that we would need to be able to do our own tracking.
Thank you. Mr. Downey?
Yeah, I'm follow up a little bit on Mr. Giancola. We have watched very closely the CAP reports and the summaries that you've given us. Some of the things I'm seeing now in the FTA aren't familiar to me, and I'm wondering, have some of these been brought newly by the TOC and then incorporated into the FTA report? I'm thinking particularly about a lot of detail on ATC and a lot on red signal running.
Okay.
And
so,
they didn't strike me as something we had on our agenda before. If it is new, I think we also should get more detail on it at a future meeting.
Okay, happy to do that. So just to set the stage, the last official report that we did, I believe, was either the end of September or the end of October. And at that time, we had, I think, 108 open caps that we were tracking. Since then, there have been a number of triennial audits that have been performed. We've been engaged in those. We've received the draft reports. We have the findings that came from those, ATC, and so on. In round numbers, there are about 100
new
caps.
Those are new by virtue of the triennial.
Not a surprise to us because we're engaged with the triennial process. So we've been seeing those, saw the findings. As I mentioned in the beginning, WMATA develops the cap.
Yeah.
So we had proposed corrective action plans to TOC at the time, and then we've also forwarded those to FTA. So they're caught in that transition in a state of flux, but they are being addressed. But to answer your question directly, probably about 100
Good.
That hadn't been formally adopted.
Again, they were somewhat surprising
to
me and probably to other members.
And some brand new, in particular the ATC, we're just trying to digest.
Yeah. And then I would hope that you're going to continue to issue your report, but somehow we can bridge from the last one to there just to make sure that no caps have been left behind.
Absolutely. That's our intention, is to provide that traceability so that we can account for everything.
Great. Thank you.
Science?
Thanks, Mr. Goldman. I think we're all keenly aware of the fact that FTA stepping in to do this work is unusual, and that they as an agency really haven't had safety oversight responsibility for very long. And so my question is really less for you, Mr. Brown, than it is for my colleagues and maybe Mr. Wiedefeld to think about, which is, does this board have an obligation as we live through this to think about how we give feedback to the FTA as the board responsible for running the service here, about whether this works well for us? Because we ultimately have to use this for decision making. We have to use it to drive our conversation about our regional funding. And we don't want to be in a position where things are going along, but we really need them to be in conversation with us as opposed to Mr. Brown's office or even Mr. Wiedefeld's office. So I just really put that out there. It is of concern to me. I know they're working hard. I know this is new for them, too. But we have a fiduciary and an oversight responsibility for this particular agency that we have to exercise as well. So I think there needs to be, we need to set a bit of a dialogue here with the administrator, too, about how they work with boards moving forward.
Thank you.
I do have one comment, because if you read MAP 21 and moving forward, and this is why it's important, if we can get you all in the safety management system class, the understanding is moving forward. It's not adopted yet, but the board will assume responsibility and buy into the corrective actions. So you will become more and more involved as we move forward. So it's important. It's very on point, Ms. Hines, your question.
Thank you. More to you, Mr. Chairman. The Transportation Planning Board had a report yesterday on the state safety oversight, the change with the TOC that's going to occur. And I'm wondering if that is something that we may want to have very soon, and I guess next month is as soon as it could be, because the projection of them going out into our states to actually codify the legislation in order to do so, and what role, as we follow through with the follow-up that we have here at safety, how we collaborate that.
Is that a suggestion that we invite transportation or the safety person from the Transportation Planning Board?
Well, it was actually from the TOC member, Mr. Smith, the chairman, and so I think it is a good understanding of where they are in trying to reach that new requirement from FTA, and it will require state legislative changes, and we may want to.
Oh, you're talking about the MSC,
yes,
Metropolitan Safety Commission.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's a good idea. Is that something you can try and work on for the next month and see if we can get someone?
Certainly, we'll take
give their perspective.
Sure.
Thank you. Just a final question on the new caps that came out from the FTA this week. As I go through numbers, and you presented the 153, of those 153, there's 102 that are completed and we don't need to do anything with except complete them. And many of them have been on our books going back to 2008, 2009. Do you have a plan of how many of those can be closed in the next 90 days, the next 6 months, so we can start to whittle down the numbers?
Right. So, and again, the terminology that WMATA would be in the position to submit all the documentation to request closure. I obviously can't control, you know, what the FTA, oftentimes we submit documentation and then there's a lot of back and forth that occurs to satisfy all of their concerns. So the actual closure of the cap may take some time. I guess I'm just to set the record straight, some of those oldest ones are the ones that are tied to NTSB investigations, or recommendations, I'm sorry. Removal of the 1,000 series cars is one of those, that the TOC had adopted the NTSB recommendation and assigned a number. That's a portion of that. And those, you're well aware, the board is well aware of our progress on the 7K purchase, and NTSB has told us they will not close that recommendation. Just giving an example of that one, until the last 1,000 series car is off of the system. And so that's still several years off, I think 2017 or something along those lines. So those kinds of ones we don't have the control to. Time will just have to take place. And that's mostly, the oldest ones are NTSB recommendations. The vast majority of those, if you'll look at the in the directive that they have, are 15-something that came over from the TOC. So they're all within a year or 2 years old. And we do move as expeditiously as possible with great cooperation, I will say, from the departments. I think we're lockstep with Mr. Troop and his staff to get the documentation as quickly as possible. Sometimes mitigations take a while to put together and have the documentation to submit. So I won't belabor the answer, but the vast majority of these are not as old as it sounds like they're characterized.
No, but what I would ask you to do is to come back next month, and why don't you try and give us a projection or a report of
right.
what your best judgment is of how many of these
right.
102 can be closed in the next 90 days, how many will take 6 months.
We can certainly do that.
How many take a year, and how many are going to have to wait till we have enough 7,000 rail cars to
right.
clean out the 1,000?
And if you'll recall, the previous TOC report had estimated
yeah.
closing. So those will stay as tracking dates. But, yes, sir.
If you can do that. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Brown, Ms. Troop.
Okay.
Chief Pavlik, are you ready to go?
Yeah, good afternoon. I just wanted to provide an update on several of the topics we you discussed earlier, the first being our Security Operation Control Center. I really can't say enough about this facility, and the pictures really don't do it justice. As far as the Chief of Police is concerned, it's a great technology advancement we've made, probably one of the greatest we've made since I've been here. And I think it shows a real commitment from this board and this authority to security and what we're doing to advance. When we look at some of the things the Security Operations Control Center does, it really is an understatement. You know, this year to date, we've had over 6,000 video requests. And those requests come from internal, external stakeholders, the Department of Risk, and it really gives us the ability to confirm an incident. And just to throw some numbers out there, through video analysis, you know, we made over 500 adult arrests, over 200 cases were closed, and over 100 cases were unfounded. And I think the unfounded is important because you might have a victim that alleges an event took place in our system, whether it be a criminal act or a safety issue. And through video analytics, we're able to confirm that event or, in turn, unfound that event, say that event never happened, and we have video evidence to prove it. So the ability that we have now as an agency to review video real-time, you know, to monitor real-time, to go back in time, and using video analytics software, how it's really advanced the security side here at Metro. The ability for what it's doing and how we partner with Johns Hopkins is just going forward so far. It's unbelievable what we're doing. And when you look at the criminal side of it, you know, from Alexandria to Fairfax to the District of Columbia, you know, through this video analytics, we can confirm when people use our system, their travel patterns, things of that nature, where you can confirm a robbery occurred or a criminal act occurred and then link that back to the event. So I can't say enough about the Security Operations Center and what they're capable of doing. When we look at the training that's going on, we've made some great leaps. You know, year to date, we've trained over 6,000 first responders, with the District of Columbia having the highest training with over 1,500 first responders from the fire side and the law enforcement side. And during that training, we focus anywhere from the layout of the stations to evacuations to safety to communications to hot sticking to WSODs. We really want to push that to our first responders and how that training is conducted. Another area where we spent a lot of time on, we used to train about a half hour for the new employee orientation, and now we're training 4 hours during new employee orientation. And for new employee orientation, we're really getting our frontline employees involved on how a scene is managed, what can you can expect if a station has to close or if we're single tracking, what they need to communicate to our riders, what they need to work partner with our first responders who are coming, what a critical incident looks like. We developed a little pocket guide for all of our employees that we're handing out now. It's tabbed and shows different types of incidents, how to respond, again, what command and control looks like during a critical incident, the role they play, whether you're a station manager, a train operator, a custodial side, but every employee plays a role during those incidents and what role they can play and how they can help us. When you look at emergency drills and exercise as part of the NTSB early recommendations and working with Mr. Troop, you know, I can't say enough positive things there. Previously, we would only be allowed to do drills in rail yards. And our first responders were like, hey, that's great, but it's not really real time what we'd like to see. So working with Mr. Troop, we've been able to do 3 large-scale drills actually on the main line, which is a big advancement for us. And the fire chiefs can't say enough about it. They love it. You know, we did the first one in April out of Greenbelt, Prince George's County, Maryland. We did another one in August at Stadium Armory, and we had one last Sunday at the Forest Glen Station on the main line. So the ability to get those firefighters on there, you know, depending on the jurisdiction, they could go months without seeing a metro station or inside a metro tunnel. So after the exercise is over, we always allow another hour or two for the firefighters to go down on the wayside and get in the tunnel and refresh themselves, because in a training environment at Carmer Turner, you know, the rollover rig is great, the tunnel's great, but to have it real world, real time inside a tunnel, they speak volumes about it. And when we come back in January with Chief Bayshore and the rest of the COG people, you know, you're going to hear more about that. And finally, we've talked about this before, the jurisdictional fire department coordination in the ROC. That goes a long way as well. I'm pleased to report now we're covering it 16 hours a day with two different firefighters. Prince George's County and Fairfax County have both stepped up. And this is great because now the fire department, we put a radio in there where the fire department can talk live with the responding jurisdiction. So through CCTV, that firefighter and through his experience relays to that fire battalion chief who's responding to, yes, we have smoke, or yes, we have an evacuation underway, or actually, no, actually it was just brake dust. You know, instead of sending four or five fire trucks, just send one because they still have a responsibility to confirm an event occurred or didn't occur. But through this real time and through that partnership in the ROC, we're able to mitigate a lot of incidents and reduce the response time so that way you're not putting so many first responders at risk, you know, four or five fire trucks responding to an incident when I only need one and it turned out to be brake dust. So the ROC liaison position is working out very well. We're going to meet on January 21st, myself and Mr. Wiedefeld with the fire chiefs, talk about this and talk about what it's going to look like in 2016. So a lot of good things are happening on the first responder side. I'd be happy to take any questions if you have them.
Questions? Welcome. Mr. Augustine.
At first, I'd just like to start by saying that on Monday, I attended a meeting. It's a community meeting, and Maryland State Senator Joanne Benson holds a meeting with a large group of seniors once a month. And at this particular meeting, there was a Sergeant Parizo and an Officer Overton who came and presented to this group of senior citizens and talked about safety and security to this group of people. And they did so in a very effective way. And I think that the people, they talked about cameras. They talked about the chemical monitoring that you're doing. And I just felt like that those people came away feeling a little bit more secure, which I think was a very good thing. And I think it's also important that the officers continue to be visible out there talking to citizens. And I just thought that that was a fantastic thing, and I wanted to make sure that we highlight what they did, because they did a great job. Also, just would like to know if we've talked about the effectiveness and the importance of this fire department coordination. Is the funding of this position, has that been a part of the discussion of the upcoming budget? I mean, have you brought it up? I mean, is this something that we do internally? Is this something that we need to talk to the jurisdictions about? I just want more clarity to make sure that we can continue this.
Yes, so if you recall, sir, WMATA, we fronted $250,000 to begin this effort. And at the burn rate or the rate at which it's being expended is not going as fast as we like. And it turned out we had the ability to send two officers over there, the second one being from Prince George's County, Maryland. So until that $250,000 runs out, which we forecast will be early spring, you know, that is one of the agenda items for the January 21st meeting is there an opportunity for the Council of Governments or a UASI grant or some type of funding through UASI, because it is a regional issue, and we want the region to help take ownership of it. You know, WMATA stepped up and did the first initial funding, but that is definitely a topic on the January 21st meeting.
Thank you. Chair Downey?
Thank you. Thank you for the report. It's really some good stuff here. Looking at the Security Operations Control Center, which I guess is now through its shakedown period and fully functioning, I'd like to get out there at some point, and I'll work with Jennifer to see if the other board members who would also like to get a look at it. And I'm wondering if, in fact, it also needs some media attention, that we should have media go and see what we're capable of doing.
Okay.
Thank you. Good suggestion.
I just wanted to share with everybody that Chief Bashur's work on this was recognized by the Council of Governments. He got the Ron Kirby Regional Excellence Award for local public service, and I think that it shines a little bit on us that we were part of this partnership. It was really nice to see him get that award.
Chief, I've gotten a comment from Maryland Ryder about some security issues in some of the stations. What he's concerned about and what he's witnessed are juveniles in the stations, more juveniles than usual, near the schools between 3 and 4 o'clock. And what he reports are some things that are fairly upsetting, bike riding in station platforms, discharge of fire extinguishers, kicking rail car windows, fights, horseplay on the platforms, and even some people jumping onto the track bed. Are these things that you're aware of? Are these, and what's the plan for addressing this greater level of sort of juvenile horseplay in the stations?
Right. So that's, 2 years ago we launched the Respect Your Ride campaign because we saw the same issues. And I think some of the behavior that you talk about is horseplay. If you saw it on a playground or on a street corner, you wouldn't give it a second look. But because it's in a confined environment on a rail car, it's the abusive language, it's the horseplay and things. So it's what we've been doing. We just started with Prince George's County this year, but last year we spent a great time in D.C. public schools and really educating our young riders to tell them the dangers that, you know, it is not a place to play because there are a lot of inherent risks and dangers within a metro station. So we continue to do that. We're always looking for opportunities to brief various schools. Prince George's County, the biggest station over there, is Preview Plaza with Northwestern High School right there. We see it more in the District of Columbia than in Prince George's County, Maryland, but a lot of it is horseplay. We're going to continue with our Respect Your Ride campaign and look for opportunities. I think sometimes it's challenging for the transit police to get out in front of a community because we're not a community like the Prince George's County Police Department and take ownership of that. Everybody looks at us and depends upon us, but they don't look at us as community policing like you see in traditional police departments. So that's a challenge that we've always been dealing with and really getting out in front of the community in those schools and getting them educated, because that's really what it's about, is educating our young riders.
Yeah. You really opened up the follow-up question I was going to ask. Do you have sufficient resources in the Metropolitan Transit Police Department to handle this, or do you need some assistance from police in the district, Prince George's County, Montgomery?
No, that assistance is always there. Is where the assistance really needed is get those doors open for us. You know, we talk with the schools. They come to us. We go to them when we see problems. But really just reinforcing that and saying, hey, we have the ability to come talk to you, and we'll come educate you and go to your PTA meetings or go to your various school assemblies. But really is getting those doors open and not just calling us after the fact, but call us before the fact.
Ms. Porter?
In the briefing materials for this presentation, you mentioned the CERT program. You know, Montgomery County, has a very robust CERT program. Are you training first responders on how to work with CERT folks, or are you actually training the CERT folks themselves?
We do both. So the CERT team was out at Sunday at Forest Glen exercise, and we love the CERT teams because they are a valuable asset to this region. So it's what we do. We offer them 24 hours of training, individual training. We bring them to a Carmen Turner facility. We'll do a drill with them. But we are trying to get them more involved, just like the Riders Advisory Council, in those drills. So whether it's Metro Access riders or the CERT teams or volunteers from the community, you saw a lot of that at the Forest Glen drill this past weekend.
Thank you. And I think that concludes our safety and security meeting for today. No further business. It is adjourned. Does Chair Downey wish to bring to our attention what the schedule is for the rest of the day?
We're heading up for the resumption of the executive session, and I would say 1:15 to start the ward meeting.
So we will.